Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, teaching teachers how to teach reading. It's more difficult than it sounds, as you'll hear in this excerpt from a new American Public Media documentary by Emily Hanford.
Lots of people believed learning to read was as natural as learning to talk.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
But it's not. There's now been decades of scientific research.
This is the most studied aspect of human learning.
Well, it may be studied, but the newest research on reading is not being used in too many American classrooms. Part of the reason for that is the teachers in training aren't learning it in college. So today, a discussion about the best way to teach reading. And as our guests join us, I'd like to tap into your expertise and experience as well. If you're an educator, experienced or fairly new to the profession, and you teach or specialize in reading, what method have you found most successful? And if you're someone who has struggled with reading or your kids are struggling with it, is there a learning method that has been most helpful? So I want to hear from educators this morning, new and experienced, about how you teach reading and how you take in the evidence, the newest evidence about how meaningful phonics is in teaching reading. And I want to hear from you if you have struggled to learn reading or your kids are in that place right now. What are the methods that are helping? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter. At Carrie NPR. Kelly Butler is with us. She's Director of Policy and Partnerships at the Barksdale Reading Institute in Mississippi. She's investigated this, written a lot about it. Kelly, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. Good to be here.
Lori Hellman is with us, Director of the Minnesota Center for Reading and Research and a professor at the University of Minnesota. She's on sabbatical in Santa Cruz, California, where we find her. Lori, I'm so glad you had a moment to join us on the show. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Kelly, I want to go right to what you found when you wanted to know how teachers at Mississippi's universities were learning to teach reading. What did you find when you began to investigate?
Well, the work that the Barksdale Reading Institute has done in Mississippi really began in the early 2000s when we were working in schools across the state and determined that the teachers in classrooms knew very little about real good practices of reading instruction. And so from there, we had begun to do some work in the universities to try to influence how teachers were being prepared to teach reading from the very beginning. And so Barksdale has done two studies over the course of the last 20 years. And the first one was in 2003, where we determined at that point in time there was about 20 minutes of phonics instruction being taught in the eight public universities across the state.
Are you saying through the entire instruction that teachers would get, there was 20 minutes on phonics?
On average, over the course of the two-year teacher preparation part of their undergraduate degree, it was pretty minimal. And we determined that they were not all teaching the five components of reading, which had been at that point in time established by the National Reading Panel.
Lori, here's what's puzzling about this. As I think Kelly points out in the documentary, years of peer-reviewed research says that kids learn to read by connecting sounds with letters, and that's phonics. Maybe you could explain how this works and why more teachers and would-be teachers aren't aware of the research.
Yeah, I was really disappointed when I heard and read the report, because I truly thought that we were past a lot of these issues. I've never worked in Mississippi. I've spent a lot of time in Minnesota and California and visited other states such as Texas and Virginia and New York. And my experience is a little different in the sense that I think, especially being a teacher in California way back when I think when we had moved to a more whole language type approach, that came sort of relatively early in my teaching career. But we really did have a strong movement, and this was back in the mid-90s, to really get the kind of information out there that Kelly is talking about, and really doing a whole statewide initiative to make sure that teachers were trained and did understand how to teach the code, how to teach kids to match letters and sounds and learn the phonetic code that is going to help them decode the language. So very disappointing to hear that that's still the case in many places.
Lori,
let me leave you all in 2003, because we've had a good bit of progress since then. So the second study that we did really determined that we had really moved the needle in terms of both teaching all five components of reading, but also increased the emphasis on teaching phonics and explicit instruction.
Lori, you use the word code. I think this is important to understand, because if you've missed the documentary, and I listened to it, so I understand that it is kind of teaching kids how to decode the connection between a sound and a letter. What else can you say about that?
Right. Thanks for asking. Because when I read the transcript, I there were people saying, I don't understand what balance means,
right,
and balanced literacy.
Right.
And I thought, really? Wow, that's so basic. But to get off to the basics, learning to read really involves two key processes. The first part is you have to be able to decode. You have to match the letters to sounds and then make those sounds fit with words that we say. So that's the decoding part, or the word recognition part, the phonics part. But there's another equally important part to learning to read, and that is the meaning part. In other words, if you don't know what a word means, you can decode it, but you're still not going to be able to extract meaning from what you're reading. So the balance is between meaning-based and code-based skills. So an example that I like to use is my family lived in Slovakia for a year, and I went there, and within about 20 minutes, somebody had showed me how to sound out the letters in Slovak. And
wow.
I could read a whole page of Slovak, but was I really reading? Because I didn't
right.
understand a word I was saying. So no, I wasn't really reading. That was the code part. On the other hand, if I were to read a letter to my friend that somebody had written her, and I didn't understand all of the connections, and I read it out loud to that person, they would be understanding. Would they be reading? No,
yeah.
Because I had done the decoding. So those two things have to work together to make reading happen.
We have a lot of people on the phone lines. Let me go to the calls here to Ashley in Red Wing. Hi, Ashley. Sounds like you've had some experience with this.
Yeah, I do. I taught first grade for 7 years and then went back to graduate school to get a master's in curriculum instruction with a reading specialist option. And teaching reading was something I was passionate about, so I was super excited to learn more. And I have a, you know, huge loan, and I didn't learn anything in the master's program.
Wow.
I learned more teaching reading as a first grade teacher than I did in school. And then this past winter, I decided to take a course at the Reading Center in Rochester in the Orton-Gillingham approach to teaching reading. And it wasn't until then that I learned how to truly help a struggling reader. And just breaking down the language into the phonemes and directly teaching phonemes and syllable, how to break apart syllables and the different types of syllables and that sort of thing.
I mean, it sounds like after all these years, you kind of had this, I don't know, somewhat of an epiphany in this class to say, so this is how this works.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I was a pretty strong teacher with the general population, but in all my schooling and professional development, I was never really shown how to truly help a struggling reader.
Kelly, is this common, or what do you take from that?
It's very common. And now that we're doing some training across the state, both with K-3 teachers who are already in the classroom, as well as new training around pre-service and including our faculty in the pre-service programs, what we're finding is that more often than not, teachers are saying, nobody ever taught me this. I never knew this. And they feel terrible because they remember all the kids that they've that have come through their classrooms that they failed to teach effectively. So the good news is that we really do know how to teach reading. And Laurie gave a great explanation of she uses the word balanced in that context. I understand it a little bit differently, but what she's explained is exactly right, that we have to decode and we have to have meaning to the words that we decode. And the difficulty is that pre-service faculty as well as their pre-service candidates don't know that basic science of reading. So we're not just saying you need to teach phonics. You got to have to. You got to have the language also.
You have to have all the rest, right?
But we know how to do it. So.
But what is clear in the documentary, Laurie, is there has been resistance to this basic around the phonics, and there has been a perception that it's a movement that comes and goes, and there's some political belief around it. And that there has been resistance to the idea of using that as a foundation for learning reading. Are you aware of that?
You know, it just makes me so sad to have it put that way. I think that I feel like I've been in this profession so long that we did have what were called the reading wars. But I guess I thought we were past that. That nobody is arguing that phonics shouldn't be a key aspect of teaching reading. And I was hoping that nobody was arguing that it's the only aspect of teaching reading too. So when I hear about people saying, well, I prefer this method or I prefer mm-hmm. that method, mm-hmm. it just makes me feel like, do we have to go back and relitigate all of that? I thought we were beyond that.
I think one of the things that's happened in the last 10 to 20 years is the cognitive and neuroscience that has been introduced in the field of education. So with these functional MRIs that we now know what the brain does when it's reading really has helped us to inform instruction. And so I think we have, as educators, have been slow to embrace what the scientific community is telling us. And we will advance our profession when we come to appreciate what science can tell us about what the brain does.
Kari says on Twitter, before my kids started kindergarten, I took them through a popular consumer-oriented phonics program. I wasn't confident that they should get solid phonics instruction at school. Today, they're very strong readers. To the phones to Christy in Rochester. Hi, Christy. How does this work in your own family?
When my daughter was in first grade, we started realizing how much she was struggling with phonics. And so we brought it up at teachers' conferences. And we asked, when will you be teaching phonics? And the response was kind of, well, we don't. It's not part of the curriculum. And so we were just left to have to, venture on our own and teach her this. And the other thing that was really sad about it was my daughter was wanting to read harder books, and they wouldn't let her because she wasn't in that reading level. And it wasn't until she got into third grade and her teacher said, she can be in whatever reading level she wants to be because she comprehends it. She was getting it. She just couldn't do the phonics part of it.
And so how is she, what kind of a reader is she today?
She loves books. She would read all day long if I would let her.
Good to have the call. Hey, thank you much to Michelle in St. Paul. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
You teach teachers, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a professor of teacher education at Hamline University in St. Paul.
What are you hearing in this discussion?
Well, what I can tell you is that there's a huge rift between my professional life and my personal life here. I'm a strong supporter of public schools, and this is the precise topic that brought me to pull my child out of public schools.
Why?
Because they weren't using research-based approaches to literacy. So what I ended up doing is pulling my child out of public schools and putting her into a Catholic school. Locally, the Catholic schools are actively training their teachers in Orton-Gillingham.
And this Orton-Gillingham, this was mentioned by one of our callers. Michelle, specifically, what is that?
So it's an approach to literacy instruction that does rely heavily on phonics. And there are a variety of approaches that fall under Orton-Gillingham, so I couldn't explain it to you exactly.
Okay.
But what I can tell is that it really is changing my daughter dramatically as far as her academic achievement.
I appreciate the call. Laurie, we've heard from a two parents here, one whose daughter was dyslexic, or they thought she might be dyslexic, and then Michelle saying a special needs child. Do the techniques change to teach reading to kids who may end up struggling to learn to read for whatever reason? Or are there ways that you just account for those difficulties, but you still use the same methods?
In general, you use the same methods. However, with a student who is struggling, you're going to want to be more explicit, more practice. You're going to want to find out what the strengths of the student are so you can really highlight those strengths and build on them. Some students will, you know, get their decoding fairly quickly. They'll just get the code and just almost, it's almost like a very invisible process because they just get it and move on and start, and you can't believe how fast they're taking off. Mm-hmm. Other students really need time, explicit instruction, hands-on activities, reinforcement, practice, maybe smaller chunks, steps. And teachers should be prepared to meet every student with their learning needs. And we do our best to make sure that our students that leave the University of Minnesota are prepared to work with those students for whom reading doesn't come easily. I just want to express some empathy for the parents as advocates. I know I taught kindergarten and first grade for 16 years, and I also have two kids who had various degrees of success with learning to read. And I think this is a team effort here, and parents should not be afraid or embarrassed about approaching teachers. And if a teacher were to say, you know, well, we don't do phonics, I mean, we need to push back, and we all need to be working on this together.
Well,
and parents,
okay, but Lori,
should be
on.
Advocates for their children.
That, yes. That sounds good. We need to push back. So what do you say to the teacher? Well, I think you should be using phonics, and if you're not going to use phonics, I'm
well,
going to have to find a school that will.
Well, my child doesn't seem to be learning. My child doesn't know what to do when faced with some text in print. And
I think
what are
the
you
reality
doing?
Sometimes mm-hmm. is that the teacher doesn't know how to do it.
Doesn't know how to use phonics. Is that right,
right
Kelly?
So, yeah. Also want to make a point about the precursor to phonics, that mm-hmm. while every child may not need explicit phonics instruction, all our brains read at the phoneme level. And so we may need varying degrees of phonics instruction, phonics is essentially the application of decoding. And if our brain is using decoding to read, then that's how phonics helps the reading process. But the precursor to phonics is also a whole realm of phonological awareness, which is the sound of the language. And I think sometimes that's not appreciated as much in core instruction leading up to phonics instruction. So if kids can't hear the sounds that they're later going to associate a symbol to, then they're at a disadvantage. And so there's a whole realm of science around just the language component of learning to read.
Kelly, just a quick question here, because since we've heard from two callers about difficult readers, are teachers, would-be teachers, being instructed on how to teach kids that don't take to reading all that easily? Do you find that they have a pretty sophisticated understanding of what to do about that?
Are you asking me if I think
yes.
current classroom teachers have a sophisticated
I am.
Understanding?
With difficult readers, yeah.
Not particularly. I think one of the things that we see around struggling readers, so many struggling readers, at least in our state, is because it's taken us a while to get core instruction up to speed. And so we have a number of kids who struggle because the basic instruction that they've had in kindergarten and first grade is not sufficient. But I think by and large, I think it's changing. And I think in different parts of the country, it's perhaps faster and there's an appreciation for this explicit instruction
approach. May I add something to
what
Kelly's
saying? Yeah, go
ahead,
Lori. Yeah,
please.
You bring up a really good point, Kelly, about the core instruction. And what I want to talk about is just a model that has been called both response to intervention and MTSS, multi-tiered systems of support. And within this system, this is a way of not putting the all of the responsibility on a single teacher, but rather on the system, the school, the district. And with MTSS, the basic foundational way that kids are served is by having quality core instruction. And I think that's what we're talking about here today, that teachers have to know the best practices. They have to implement them with every student in their classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But then beyond that, not every student, just by getting quality core instruction, will learn to read or will read easily. There might be about 20% of kids who need some supplementary help. And so then we want to look at using database decision making and finding ways to give those students some extra support, 20 to 30 minutes a day, so that they can catch up with their peers and learn in more explicit and systematic ways.
Jessica.
So this is all part of the system.
Jessica says on Twitter, I'm in the grad teaching license program at St. Scholastica for social science, and we have a whole class devoted to adolescent literacy. Once kids learn to decode words, we need to infuse literacy into all content classes for enhanced reading comprehension, not just English class. Bruce says, wasn't the switch away from phonics in the 1960s viewed with suspicion? And didn't that switch and the consequent failure lead to a general mistrust of jumping into fads like the new math? Aren't the fads always pushed by people who stand to make money? Kelly, I think he's kind of encapsulated the politics around this and why there has been distrust about phonics.
Right. I think there are a lot of politics around it. I think one of the things that would help us most in our work here in Mississippi around teacher preparation is to try to create a more seamless system for teacher preparation that and to bring in the pre-service programs to recognize that their product is not just a graduate with a certificate, but that their product is how well their own students will perform once out in the classroom in K-12 achievement. And until we can make that a seamless circuit, I think we're going to continue to be in these silos where one part of the system is not informing the other.
Yeah.
And that's really what we're trying to do here in Mississippi is to bring the pre-service faculty into this K-12 challenge that we have around literacy and help them lead us. But we've all got to get on the same page in terms of appreciating what the science is telling us about how the brain reads.
I just want to make sure that I'm saying would-be teachers, you're saying pre-service faculty. We're talking about teachers who are in training to be teachers, right? Students who are learning to be teachers.
We're really talking about both, because even the faculty that I'm working with now who say I have an advanced degree in elementary education or in curriculum, I never learned the science of reading.
Oh.
So they too are in this learning curve.
Molly in Minnetonka says, my daughter is in the second grade. She struggled with reading for 2 years. We've used Orton Gillingham. It's shocking how hard public schools fail these students. And then Amy in Matamidi called to say, I have a fourth grader that struggled since kindergarten. He redid I can't translate that. He worked with a specialist and it's helped. In Matamidi, they need to teach a certain way of teaching Orton Gillingham. I'm working to change the system. And to the phones here to Carrie in Roseville. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
What would you want to say about this?
Well, so I went through college and then started teaching and realized that I thought I knew what I was doing. And then luckily had an opportunity when I was teaching I've taught in 5 different states. And when I was in Iowa, I got to get a job as a reading recovery teacher, which is an intense year of teaching first grade struggling readers.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I knew what I was doing when I was a classroom teacher. And then I took that year long training and I realized, oh my God, I didn't know what I was doing. And reading recovery focuses on what your callers were saying, or that your guests were saying, that it focuses on meaning and visual, but it also focuses on the structure of our language that also helps us to form sentences. And then since then, I have gotten a master's, and I teach teachers how to teach students how to read.
Oh, good.
And and it is really, so my last job, like we, you know, I did lots of professional development around core instruction to try to get the core instruction stronger in the classroom so there'd be less kids that were struggling and that they were sending out for interventions. And then I also taught teachers that were doing the interventions how to look at meaning and structural and visual information when kids were reading and use that data to help support the kids. Mm-hmm. And it floors me when teachers like say, I didn't know any of this. I didn't know that this is how I could help a kid to read.
Well, and Carrie, you were doing this in Minnesota?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so you were hearing Minnesota teachers say to you, I never learned any of this, which, Lori, I emphasize that because we started the show with you saying, I thought we were past that. I've been to other states. We're doing this in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound to me like this is getting through to, you know,
it
teachers
and training.
It shows
there's more work to be done, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what else does it say to you?
Well, I wonder if it would be helpful to talk about some of the ways, some accountability measures that have been put in place to ensure that
that's a good
teachers
idea.
Really know.
How do we know if teachers understand how to teach reading? Is that right? And if they're doing
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So well, there's accountability at various levels. One piece is that many states now have basically a reading instruction test for their candidates before they get their teaching license. And this is a very in-depth, very phonics-based, but also includes the meaning components of how you teach reading and what it takes to give that explicit and clear instruction that students need. So a passing of a reading test is one form of accountability. Another thing that we have is that the state departments in the Board of Teaching in Minnesota has some standards for what needs to be included in coursework for teacher preparation. Mm-hmm. And there are just dozens and dozens of standards that relate to both code and meaning-based aspects of teaching reading. Many, many questions on phonics, on phonological awareness, sounds, and how to put these into place in the classroom. So we have to remember that that teachers need two things. They need the content knowledge. They need to know what a sound and a letter and a vowel team and all kinds of phonics things are. But then they also need to know how to teach it. That's the pedagogical knowledge. And those two things come together. And so, for instance, in our program at the University of Minnesota, we have a five-year program. And our students, as an undergrad, they take reading foundations where they actually work with a primary grade and an upper grade student and watch them develop their reading skills and mm-hmm. give them lots of assessments and find out what they struggle with and give them support. They also have a class in using children's literature. They have a special education practicum. And then once they have gotten their BS, their undergrad degree, they come back for a full year where they get a full class on reading instruction, and they're embedded in a classroom. So they're learning the content knowledge, but then they're also getting the pedagogical knowledge by applying all of these assignments and evaluations within their classroom. And okay. they do language arts. They learn about how to work with students learning English. All of this embedded in a year-long co-teaching placement. So this is all bound and governed by standards.
Kelly, have you found that there are measures in some of these other schools, also within Mississippi, because that's what you were investigating, where you come back to find out whether the teachers understand, you know, how to do this, whether they've learned some of the things that Lori just described?
Yes, and our work in the K-3 system over the last 20 years has seen a shift once teachers are getting the kind of training that they need. Unfortunately, in Mississippi, it wasn't coming from their pre-service program. It was coming after the fact. We have a new Literacy-Based Promotion Act here, which is essentially a third-grade law. And that kind of was a wake-up call for our state. And the concern was that it was going to be on the back of the burden of on the backs of kids rather than teachers changing instruction. And so the legislature has given a good bit of money over the past 5 years to do some retraining of teachers in K-3. The accountability model that Lori just described is a really beautiful one, and I echo the importance of this idea of accountability. What's happening, though, is that the university preparation programs are not really, while they have to produce candidates that can pass a foundations of reading test, mm-hmm. it assumes that they know how to do it. And so we're finding ourselves in this situation where we've got candidates who have to pass that foundations, and yet we have faculty who need help in teaching them the science of reading.
Okay.
So I think there's a big assumption that just because there's an advanced degree, there's an understanding about the science of reading, and that's just not the case.
And I think we've heard that today, Kelly. I mean, think of the number of listeners who've called to say, I got my master's, I thought I knew how to do this, and then I went for that special course.
Right. And what you're hearing are a lot of teachers are figuring out how to get the training, but it's not typically coming through the university
right.
programs, even the master's and PhD programs.
Lori, we have so many people on the lines. I want to continue to hear from listeners. Sarah says, I'm filled with mom guilt, knowing my daughter wasn't reading, had her tested through the school. I was told nothing was wrong. After elementary school, I got her a neuropsych evaluation to discover she's a severe dyslexic. The schools failed her. Now at 15, she's going to a boarding school in New York. Heather says here, I think this is important, 75% of unemployed adults have reading or writing difficulties, and that comes from the National Institute for Literacy. And to the phones, to Luke in Gilbert, Minnesota. Hi, Luke. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Hey, well, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate this topic.
Sure.
This is something that's very interesting to me. Growing up in the 80s, born in 1980, just before the phonics era, they were kind of in the mid-90s, so right around that time, kind of hooked on phonics, became big. But I learned to read. I was homeschooled. And my parents had the foresight to see that we needed to learn how the structure of words worked. We learned math the same way, Common Core math. I learned how to do Common Core math in the 80s. What was interesting for me is that I wasn't ready to learn to read until I was probably about 8 or 9, maybe even close to 10. But in that area, it just didn't stick. You know, I was taught phonics, I was taught sight reading, we were taught all these different things. But one day I was given a book that was interesting to me, and it just clicked. And from that point on, I loved reading. I read every classic you can imagine. And what was interesting to me is that you kind of get pigeonholed, right, at that time. And maybe I wasn't very smart or some of these things. When I went into college, I found out that I have a high IQ. I was actually linguistic on that side, very, very strong. Thinking outside the box, all that stuff was my strong suit. But I just wasn't ready. So it was almost like I was made to read, but just wasn't ready to get there yet. And forcing you in that kind of hurts you.
I'm really glad you called, Luke. It's part of the reason I wanted to take your call because, Kelly, I think it's mentioned in Emily's documentary that there are some teachers who believe that if you just surround kids with books, they'll somehow pick it up. You know, in some ways, that's what Luke is saying. I wasn't picking up. What do you think of the foundation of that?
Sounds like Luke was a fortunate candidate who really had good, strong language and was able to understand the structure of the language as he began to delve into literature and all that. And as I said before, not every student is going to need explicit phonics instruction, but even Luke, his brain is processing that language at the phoneme level. And even though it may seem so automatic that it doesn't appear that way, that he's just reading whole words, his brain has figured out how to do that. So the language is based on this phoneme-grapheme correspondence, and that's what the brain does when it takes print off of a page and puts language to it and meaning to it.
Lori, I also want to emphasize here that this is not about, you often hear, well, if you have educated parents and you grow up in a house surrounded by books, then you will automatically be a great reader. I saw this statistic that kids in many college-educated families are struggling with reading. it isn't necessarily connected to education levels of parents, is it? Or what do we know about that?
Well, I think what we know is that languages is really bolsters that language part of the mix. And so the more language that kids are experiencing, the more conversation, the more songs, the more listening to books, the more just opportunities to hear and engage with language, that's really going to support that language part of the learning to read mix. So some parents sometimes say, oh, my kid, they just learned to read from having books around. But really, if you look at that student's experience, you can see that actually probably parents were doing a lot of informal teaching through the book work by talking about the sounds of letters and pointing out words and so on. So I don't think nobody can really say that reading happens just by magic like that. But on the other hand, most kids will not learn just from being around books. They need some explicit instruction, and they need to learn that code. So, it's we all need the code, like Kelly was saying. And if you can only memorize so many words, if you've been trying to just memorize words, what happens is your brain kind of maxes out at about the third or fourth grade level. And then that's where we sometimes hit that fourth grade slump where the brain has maxed out on memorizing whole words and you don't know the code, so you can't go anywhere from there. You have to go back and learn phonics.
That's why that happens in third or fourth grade. I didn't realize that. And then do many teachers spot that? I mean, do they understand what you've just described?
You know, it's interesting because what happens sometimes is a student can look like a really good reader just because they've memorized a whole lot of words. And then when they start to struggle in the third or fourth grade, the teacher can't figure it out. And so I always, you know, recommend that they go back and do the phonics assessment. One thing I work on is with developmental spelling. So give a developmental spelling test. See how the child is actually using the code to do their writing. And you can find out a lot about what they understand about the code. And oftentimes, even a third or fourth grader, you find that they don't really know the code.
Oh. If you've just tuned into the show, getting to the end of it here, you're hearing Kelly Butler, Director of Policy and Partnerships at the Barksdale Reading Institute in Jackson, Mississippi, and Lori Hellman, Professor of Curriculum at the University of Minnesota. If you're an educator, maybe you're new to the profession, I'd love to know if you've learned a lot of what we're discussing this morning as a new teacher. If you're someone who has struggled with reading yourself or you have a child who struggled with it, is there a learning method that's been helpful? What are you drawing from what you're hearing so far today? That'd be interesting to know, too. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Laura says, my second grader is a gifted reader, and besides reading to her every day, I really can't claim credit for it. My son is in kindergarten. He's shown very little interest in reading. We're in a good school district, but I do worry that he'll slip through the cracks. Kelly, does that happen with kids who, as Lori was saying, max out in third or fourth grade, or they just become known in the school system as a kid who's not a good reader?
Well, it can happen probably with that mother. It's not going to happen in that child's case. And I think Lori's talked about this multi-tier system of support, which is pretty universal across the country. And so kids are getting picked up before they fail. And that's the whole purpose of that system, so that we don't wait until they're in third grade and are non-readers. We pick it up much earlier because we know what to look for.
Call here from Marianne in Minnesota. Hi, Marianne.
Hi.
Hi.
I think your discussion has been wonderful.
Good.
The two professionals you have are right on target. I was part of one of the universities that were funded by NIH to look into why kids become dyslexic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? In other words, they can't understand phonics, among mm-hmm. other things. And there were five findings that came out in the National Reading Panel report that children needed to have phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, which is reading comfortably at a rate they can understand, as well as comprehension and vocabulary. Those mm-hmm. are the five bulwarks.
Mm-hmm.
And the International Dyslexia Association has a certification program in which we look at teachers in mostly in master's programs, but some undergraduates, to see if the teachers themselves have the requisite knowledge to teach teachers. But what? Then we also carefully look at the curriculum they're teaching and how they assess if the students learned it. It's a very rigorous process for the colleges that pass. Mm-hmm. And I've been on one of those panels. I'm about to be on another.
Okay.
But I think you can look for colleges that really know what they're doing.
That's a good point. Yeah, Kelly, did you? Your work was within what I think the 8 universities in Mississippi, right?
Well, the first study we did was just with the 8 public universities because at that point in time, Barksdale was funding some faculty members in those public universities. When we repeated the study in 2014, we included all 15 preparation programs. So we have 7 private institutions. All of the colleges and universities in Mississippi have a teacher prep program. And all 15 voluntarily participated. They were very interested in knowing how their program stacked up against a requirement that the state has for what early literacy instruction should look like at the pre-service level.
What'd you find out?
Well, as I said earlier, the needle has moved. All 15 programs, and certainly from the 8 that we previously studied, have included in their course descriptions for Early Literacy 1 and Early Literacy 2, which is a 6-hour block that is designed to cover all 5 components of reading, which, remember, came out of the first study that we weren't doing that. And so the State Department created a licensure requirement around those 6 hours. Now what we find is that the course descriptions have changed, and we are teaching about 300 minutes of phonics instruction on average across the state. But we are still not teaching all 5 components in every institution. For example, there are a couple of institutions where when you look at both the syllabus and the course outline, the course instruction, and when you observe the instruction, which is what we did, which would really made our study different, it was a much deeper look. We determined that they weren't teaching all 5 components, so fluency was sometimes missed.
Amy says here, there's a recurring theme, I think she means in this show, that parents need to support and intervene when reading doesn't click for their kids. We moved our son to Groves Academy because they know how to teach kids with dyslexia how to read. What about families without those resources? Lori, I thought we were emphasizing you've got to get to the teachers who are teaching the teachers so they'll bring this into the classroom. Perhaps you do have a suggestion, though, for what parents can do if they find themselves in a situation where they just don't think their kids are getting the right instruction.
Right. And if you don't mind, I'll click back with something we were talking about earlier, which is what about those faculty members who they got their degree and now how do they keep learning and how do they keep making sure they're up with the latest research as well? And I just wanted to do a call out for a group that I work with in Minnesota, which we call HELP, or Higher Education Literacy Partnership. And it's really aimed at bringing together faculty who teach literacy courses. And every year we bring in a distinguished reading researcher to do a day-long talk. This year it's going to be on Friday, this Friday, September 28th. And coming in is Sharon Vaughn from the University of Texas, Austin. But in the previous years, we brought in Marianne Wolfe, Catherine Snow, Noni Lasso, Steve Graham, Barbara Foreman. These are the real distinguished luminaries in the field who bring up a lot of information about how to really address reading problems and how to make sure that faculty help their students learn to be proficient in this area. So just a call out to my group, and people can find out
I'm
more.
I'm glad to know about that. I'm glad to know about that group, Lori, because we have started something here also called the Higher Ed Literacy Council, and it does
fantastic.
A similar thing.
And yeah, and it's got the folks from dyslexia organizations, from various universities, from the Department of Ed. So it's really, I think partnerships are really, really key to making change.
And it's breaking down those silos so that the higher ed folks can talk to the state
folks.
You know?
Kelly,
exactly.
Maybe, but go ahead, Lori, just to come back to the parents.
Well, I was just
going to
say back to your question.
Yeah, please.
Yes, I guess before I wasn't saying it. It shouldn't have to be the parent's responsibility. It should be the responsibility of the school to address each child's learning need. And I think what I was trying to say before is that, but parents shouldn't feel like they should just sit back and wait. They should feel free to, they should get, be there and ask questions and express things that sometimes I've had teachers say, you know, that, well, they've had kids in their class, the parents come in for the conference and they say, my child can read. And they say, oh, I didn't know that. We were doing the letter B this week or whatever. Mm. So, you know, I think parents do have to speak up for their children. Yeah, it's important.
I want to mention something.
Yeah, Kelly,
go ahead.
I want to mention something because I think the parents can. This is an avenue for parents as well. Is what the publishing industry is doing to this whole issue of reading instruction. I'd be interested in what Laurie has to say about this, because I find that often the districts adopt a program that has all of the right stickers on it that says it's aligned with standards and so forth. But when you delve into the program, you determine that it's really not doing a very good job of teaching reading the way we really know that it should be taught. And so, but it's really driving how we teach reading across the country. And I'm just curious what Laurie's take on that and what she's found in terms of good programs versus, you know, what and
yeah,
what parents
I try to be I try to be program agnostic a little bit, you know, because I don't want to be supporting any one program. I think the main problem with those basal programs, those statewide programs, is that there's just too much there. That no, there's just not enough time in the day for teachers to do everything that, that is in those teacher manuals. So when I work with teachers, pre-service or reading specialists or teachers in practice, what I make sure, try to make sure, is that they're getting a certain spread of literacy instruction in the classroom every day. And one of those key components we call word study. So we want to make sure that that's kind of the phonics part, because at the beginning, phonics is, you know, letter sound matches. But as you get into the second, third and up, you're going to want phonics to be more complicated than that. It's going to be about vowel teams, and then it's going to be about how to decode multisyllable words, and then it's going to be how to look at for Latin and Greek roots within words to really take words apart and build meaning with them. So that's a really key aspect of the literacy program every single day. And you're going to want to look at any program that is purchased and say, is it addressing those big five elements? Is it looking at phonological awareness, phonics,
and
fluency,
you're also talking about a scope and sequence. So what sequence do they introduce those? I think that's
exactly.
Piece of
so
that
what,
too.
What's appropriate for kindergarten is not going to be appropriate for third grade, most likely.
Is this the first time you two have met? It sounds like you have a lot to talk about.
We do.
I think there ought to be a phone call that follows this. Peter called to say, it's acceptable to admit that you're not good at math, but it's not for reading. Kids are embarrassed to admit that. Kelly, I wondered about that. Whether, you know, the parents, teachers may be the last to know because kids don't want to step up to admit that when the class is moving on.
Right. Well, and I think the distinction with math is that you've got to have reading. I think you do have to have some basic math, too, to get ahead in life. Everything relies on reading. Everything. I think kids assume when they get into a classroom and they're struggling and they look around and see that other kids don't seem to be struggling, it's easy to go undercover. Yeah. That's why this multi-tier system of support that Laurie talked about is so important. It's that the teachers need to know so that they don't fall through the cracks.
Really good to have you both. I encourage you to keep the conversation going between you, but thank you for spending time with us. Thanks.
Thank you.
Kelly, thanks to your callers.
Kelly Butler with us from the Barksdale Reading Institute and Laurie Hellman with us from the University of Minnesota. I will tweet a link out to Emily Hanford's terrific documentary. I recommend a listen. It ignited this conversation and really taught me a lot of things I didn't know about the topic.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRI NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.